Good morning, everyone. This is Joe Gray with Seven Generations Radio, and I'm here with my good friend Jim Surkamp. Jim is
hello.
Hello, Jim.
Am I fired up?
You are fired up. You should be up and running.
Am I?
Yep. Can you hear okay?
Uh-huh.
Okay, good. I can turn this volume up a little bit if you need to.
Yeah, sounds good.
And, Jim, we have talked about things we're going to talk about, and a couple of those were, one, we were going to talk about what's happened during our lifetime.
And oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, like...
Hey, by the way, just talking about our lifetimes, I heard yesterday that Jan Hafer in Shepherdstown's running for county commission, so
yeah,
there you go.
She's fantastic. Yeah, I don't know anybody that doesn't love Jan. I think she's going to be a shoe-in.
Yeah. So that just happened. I think it's happening as we speak or anything, but yeah. So we have another plan here today, don't we?
Absolutely. And, yeah, she's going to be a real benefit to the county once she gets on there, and I'm sure she will. Yeah, Jim, we had talked about a couple of things. One, work that you've been doing regarding a Civil War family that was working on fighting on both sides of the fence. And we're also going to talk about the things that the changes, basically,
uh-huh.
we've seen changes in our lifetime. Yeah, I should have put that song on, changes.
Well, here, let's say this, Joe. I'm going to say a little quickie, and then I'd like to do the changes first, and then what I'm going to put on the web in about a week about divided family, mm-hmm. in that order. But let's just say... I want to say that in the next few days at a site called CivilWarScholars.com, which I've been doing for 5 years with American Public University on just the Civil War in this area, I'm going to post an illustrated four-part story, true story, about Newton D. Baker. It's called Newton D. Baker's Most Divided Family. And he grew up he lived on German Street in Shepherdstown. It delves into how each generation rebels against the previous one. And this, I have 30,000 words on this thing. And we'll simply say, here's a family where Newton D's mother, father, and uncle were Union people. And what does he do but go off and join Company F of the 1st Virginia Cavalry, Jeb Stuart, along with 11 other cousins who lived nearby, and then to make the divided even worse, four other cousins went for the North. And so anyway, that's coming up in about Wednesday on the web, and we'll talk, I'll quote some beautiful comments and quotes about from that in the latter part of our broadcast.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Sounds like very interesting, and with a large family like that, when you got a lot of cousins, you're going to get some divisions.
It's going to be an interesting Thanksgiving dinner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you bet. If you can go get them all around the table. Well, I grew up, I'm one of 10 myself, and that kind of jumps us over into our next segment. And when I grew up, okay, I didn't have a lot of people living around me. I grew up in Florida. We had a cow, and my parents raised rabbits to supplement the income, among other things.
Envy.
That didn't last too long, that segment right there. And then my dad got in with the fire department and worked for them for many years, and he recently passed on. But with 9 brothers and sisters, and we grew up, well, we had the milk from the cow, and my mother made butter from the milk.
Oh, man.
And later she'd take a can of Crisco and mix up some kind of yellow dye and make margarine out of it.
And they always said Crisco is what made the fried chicken so good.
Yeah, right. And the rabbits.
Yeah, man, I'm envious.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll contrast, okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Here's little Jimmy Surkamp, grades 1 through 4 in the late 50s, living in 973 North Longfellow Street in Arlington, Virginia, not far away from Williston Shopping Center. And I remember walking around the cavernous, empty insides of a new thing called Seven Corners.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that gives you perspective. But here's what I'm getting at. You gave your story, which I think is wonderful, Joe. I would go out the door on a Saturday morning. Remember, I'm only not even 10. And my parents, I just said, I'll be back. They just said, be back by sundown.
Yeah, I know. I know what you mean.
Right?
Yeah.
That's the big difference. So they just let me go out there. He'll be all right. And I'd roam and roam and roam, and I'd go over to Williston, and I was one of those baseball card guys, and I'd buy so many baseball cards. I had this big welt of bubble gum in my mouth while I was up ripping them open, and but they just let you roam.
Yeah, a nickel. You could get a pack of gum. Right. Well, you had the Fleer's bubble gum, and then you had the ones with the cards, with the baseball cards.
Yeah.
Pee Wee Reese,
yeah.
Mickey Mantle, and all those guys.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I got the whole series in 1959, so which is probably why I became a historian. Now, but what I'm getting at, we all can remember that you'd be back by sundown, and you'd run and run and run all day long, and then you hear your mother call, Jim, dinner, and you're coated, caked with dust, and there's sweat on your dust, on your face. You know, it's all caked on because you've been running your little tush off all day long. And it's like the poem by Dylan Thomas called Fern Hill. Remember that wonderful line? All summer long I ran my heedless ways. And that was what growing up was for me. One other thing is, I don't know, if you live in a subdivision or suburbs, there's always this thing where kids would sort of morph out of nowhere, and there was a baseball game, or there was some kind of game. Or the ball, the old dusty diamond, and you just sort of come out of nowhere, and you choose up sides, and you just dreaded you're going to be the last one picked and all that. Yep. So I'll bet a lot of people listening can relate to that.
And the funny thing is, you don't see so much of that nowadays. It's one of those things that went by the wayside with all of the organization, the organized leagues and teams and the competition and all that.
All structured.
And it used to be just a bunch of neighborhood kids, and you'd go down the road and say, hey, Jimmy, you ready to play ball today?
What was the phrase? Get up a game, right?
Bring your cousin Billy, and we'll go out there and hit some balls around,
Totally.
And there'd be some weeds there, You knock the ball out there in the weeds, and you have to hunt for it and stuff like that.
You remember when you had a little league, there was always the youngest little tiny guy was always put out in center field. And and when the bat cracked and there was a long fly ball out to center field, that little kid probably had his face in his glove and was daydreaming.
Right. Yeah, that was probably me. Yeah.
Me too.
But I think I was right field,
But here's the thing. What happened? Something happened in the mid-70s where it became, you were encouraged to be a consumer, and what you owned was important. And all I can say is there was this thing called the growing beginning of a culture of indebtedness. You had to keep up with your neighbors, and colleges started raising their tuitions faster than the cost of living. As soon as you had student loans, they would start increasing it. And somehow even healthcare and colleges, because we all think health and education are sinless, so to speak, we all bought into this. Before the 70s, it was unheard of that you get a loan for a car purchase.
Yeah. So college education was, even at that point, it was really affordable. If you took out a loan, it wasn't going to break you,
We've gotten into this sort of, we've almost entrapped ourselves. And then families are so, like you said, ballet and horseback riding and sports and soccer, and you got to drive everywhere all over for the regional tournament and all that. It's so, structured and pressured.
So much has changed. It's actually difficult to even address the issue. But I started making a list of what I thought were significant changes. I think I got up over 30 some, and I just kind of, threw up my hands. It's like, it's unprecedented. I think what we have experienced in terms of change during our lifetime is unprecedented in the world. The only people, you could say the change has been more dramatic for people if you look at the march of history, but for catastrophic events, people who go through war, are displaced by slavery, people who are kicked off their land because they're indigenous people. Now, these people went through unbelievable changes. But, and it almost, it's something I don't think we think about that much when we think about change, but our change has been
self-inflicted.
Well, there you go. That's a good way to put it. And without realizing, I mean, we have gone beyond the pace of nature. Nature has a pace of change. You know, the glacial melt, the ice age, the whole evolutionary process. And what we've done is we have accelerated this thing to such proportions that we actually now threaten our own existence because of the pace of change.
And, you know, you're talking about, you know, what about our response to these challenges? You know, we grew up in a generation where you would write a long, detailed book about something important, and you were William Faulkner. And what I'm getting at is people had long attention spans.
Mm-hmm.
And you're hearing it more and more. Even the cleverest people on NPR, they're all saying, I have less attention span.
Well, that's true, and I kind of noticed that myself. I don't know whether it's old age or what the heck is that?
That's our out.
But, yeah.
But what happens if everybody is all sound bites and tweets, and how do you solve did you know the sad topic, the Challenger accident, then there was a second accident. They did an investigation, and one of the conclusions, not the Challenger but the second accident, was they relied so much on PowerPoint to train that there wasn't communicated a deep understanding of what was needed to be known and understood to make the event, you know, the launch work successfully. But these technologies are doing these strange things to that slow, deliberate way of looking at things.
Well, that's true. And, you know, I talk to young people, like a child playing a video game,
right,
and try to convince them that the world of nature is much more exciting, much more elaborate, much more intricate than what they're seeing in the video game. And yet what they think they see is totally the opposite, that is where all the excitement is.
It's an algorithm. You know, here's a great example by contrast. E.O. Wilson at Harvard is considered a great, great scientist. And he was at one point a country boy in Mississippi. His parents were divorced. He was blind in one eye, and he'd just go off for hours and days and just become enthralled with what? Ants. And he became this phenomenal expert on ants. And you go, boy, that's weird. But then he caused a revolution in the academic world, saying, here's insights into what I call a new field called sociobiology, and how it gives us indications of we as a people, you know, we compete, but somehow we know we have to cooperate. He started drawing parallels to us. But he had all that time in the world to explore, and it's different.
It is, and I was talking to my grandson, and he said, you know, Papa, what's the most important thing in the world? And I said, well, you are. And I think that kind of surprised him. And then I said, well, and then at times I am. And then sometimes it's that little bee crawling around in the flower.
That's the most important. Patience and observation, yeah.
So
that's a creativity, you know? You can't be creative if you're always being pushed along.
And this is why things like Jan Hummer does with Open Minds, mm-hmm, where they teach children mindfulness. And really, mindfulness is, I guess, our true nature. But it's somehow been breached and, mm-hmm, you know, tossed aside. We've lost touch with it. And now we actually have to do exercises to try to recapture a little bit of it.
Yeah. You think of Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist monk, who I think is right up there with the Dalai Lama. Mm-hmm. And then in the Western side, there's a woman at Harvard who's incredibly cool named Ellen Langer, L-A-N-G-E-R, who kind of put mindfulness into you know, an acceptable Western academic thing. Some really good articles on the web about her.
Hmm. Sounds good. I'll look her up. But, you know, going back to some of the changes we've been through, okay, we talked a little bit about technology. One that kind of strikes me is security, and maybe it's just my own experience, because You know, when I talk to people, for example, African Americans, I don't think they had the same sense of security that I had.
I had almost a reverse experience.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't afraid of cops. I could get on the bus at the age of like 5 or 6 years old and travel alone. You know, it seems it seems totally unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But I had no sense of personal of concern for my own safety. But I'll tell you one thing that did impress me about getting on that bus was the sign on the back of the bus. Mm-hmm. It said colored to the rear of the bus. Mm-hmm. And I sat there, you know, always wondering, well, what if they don't want to go to the rear of the bus? How do they feel about this? Why is that there? Well, you know, the whole question of race has gone from that overt, in-your-face stuff where you had separate drinking fountains for white and what they called colored, to now where it's, you know, it's still there. I think the racism is still there, but it's subtle now.
But there's exactly. There's kind of a, I call it civil rights 2.0, you know, the Black Lives Matter thing. What I'm saying is, yes, it's still there, but kind of someone like me, you know, a white American guy, seeing those just shocking over and over videos of a cop just shooting somebody at distance, open many eyes. So anyway, I think there's more awareness, and I think this generation of African Americans are more assertive. But you know, the guys who grew up, they always talked about. John Howard Griffin had this in his book about called Black Like Me. He said the worst thing back in the 50s was the hate stare, because it had so much implication and danger in it. So, you know, their story's different. And thank God for Martin Luther King.
Exactly that. So these things that we talk about, change and experience, you know, in large part we're talking about white experience and and kind of an isolated type of experience. Not that in our own terms our lives did not seem difficult at times. I mean, everybody has their difficulties, numbers of trips I took to the hospital for one thing or the other. And I don't know how my parents...
Oh, my God.
How could they have paid for it today?
That's the downside of us roaming.
You know, and they never said, you know, you're breaking us. We can't afford you anymore because
you could take your whole, you know, family out to dinner. If your dad worked for the railroad, you could take a whole family out for Sunday dinner. But one thing I wanted to say was... The insecurity, the anxiety today, people need to understand that underneath our daily lives from after World War II up till today, we had an enormous benefit. After this World War II, we were like 60% of the entire world's gross national product. Mm-hmm. And we had what you call a temporary asymmetry, where we had a huge advantage and we lived well. Well, you don't need to hear me say that everybody else has gotten their game together, and now we're in a world of very more educated, competing countries, and it's taking away from us. So we had a temporary advantage that's gone away, and that's where a lot of the anxiety is, I think.
We did have a lot of advantages the post-World War. I think there was a lot of goodwill toward the U.S. in the post war era that was. I remember I was in Europe in the 90s, late 90s, and I was talking with someone in Eastern Europe, and they said, we can always tell an American. And I said, well, why is that? I said, because they walk without fear.
How interesting.
Yeah, that really got me. And I said, wow. And I did notice that people... did look a little different, you know, between, well, they say the ugly American, the brash, the Hawaiian shirt, they go over there, they're overfed, they're over this, they're over that, and they make too much noise and they're brash and all that
and
sort of
big.
Stuff.
And they're big, they're physically
they're
bigger.
They're actually bigger, yeah, they're bigger. But this fear thing, and now that's changed too, and I don't think Americans quite have that same posture going for them.
We kind of lost a lot of respect, I guess. I do think with the W era, George W, and then the banks really precipitating, you know, the world global collapse. We lost a lot of our respect as an international leader.
I think capitalism itself has done a lot of damage in the sense that we have looked at foreign countries as markets and tried to convert them so that they would be good democratic countries that were also good capitalist countries. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of resentment built up because of this.
The way the banks have become a political weapon is really, really not good. But on the good side, Americans are crazy creative. I mean, you know, you go on YouTube and you see these kids, particularly out west, jumping off cliffs and bungee, you know, doing these insanely dangerous things. And there's this bravado. And, of course, Silicon Valley, just incredibly. It's the good news of being free. We just reach for stuff and try stuff. And we're probably the only culture in the whole world that would actually talk about disruptive technologies.
Well, it's kind of the outgrowth of the hierarchy of human needs that Abraham Maslow described. Mm-hmm. Once you've satisfied your need for food and shelter, then you can move on to social needs and creativity type of things. Mm-hmm. I'm sure a lot of what was done was in early on was because, well, you had to for survival, necessity being the mother of invention. But then it's like now it's taken a different turn. It's creativity instead of necessity, maybe. I'm sure there's a lot going on in
but
the necessity category.
If you were to find something that was really American, it's this creativity. And if you allow me, Joe, I'm going to go back to another little scene that I bet I wasn't the only one. You're going to love this.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
I'd get behind a chair in the corner of a living room at night, and I'd have one of those little radio. You know, you're going to get this. And I remember turning on the radio, and I'd listen to Sam Cooke, You Send Me, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And I'll bet all during the 50s and 60s, there was people all over the world, young people who would tune into some fuzzy radio station and hear this new music. And there's that. What I'm saying is African Americans knew you needed music to keep sane, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's where its power is, this enormous I know why the cage bird sings thing, you know? The blues showed you how you survive under any circumstances. Wow, that thread of music has changed the whole world, that part of our culture.
And someone commented to me once that in the days when we were growing up, everyone, at least that I knew in the community that I'm basically coming from myself, we all shared the same music.
Yeah.
It was coming up. The next tune would come up. The next artist
would
come up.
We'd all get it. We're all together on it.
And now so much is coming up. You know, I think it's all kind of divided up into different groups, focus groups of different genres of music and
right.
so forth.
It was pure chaos in the 60s, and that was the fun part.
Yeah.
The suits lost control.
Well, boy, now you're bringing on another good one here, the 60s. Okay. Anti-war, Vietnam War, the drug era, a beginning, at least awareness.
How to describe it, right?
The sexual revolution, the pill, the absence of AIDS. There were a lot of things going on here that dramatically...
Serious cultural revolution that succeeded.
Exactly. It did. It changed. And the question of the breakups, really, of the family, people moved on because they could. Mm-hmm. The ability to travel. People didn't look at the world... Like
the
just
family unit.
Exactly.
You know.
And the community. And the community dependency and sustainability.
And maybe we need that more now. Hey, do you know what? We all noticed that Paul Kantner of the Jefferson Airplane died a few days ago. And he has his little place in history for one of the best quotes of the 60s. Now, I remember it, so I'm not doing so bad. Mm-hmm. He's the one who said, if you were there, you don't remember it.
Okay.
Referencing pot, et cetera.
Sure. Well, I don't know. You know, and
it was very important, though. It really did something amazing.
Music did. Music really did have a profound effect. And, of course, we're standing on the shoulders of people that went through the Great Depression and then World War II.
They had to submit, right?
They submitted. They put their nose to the grindstone. They were careful with their money. They protected their children. And they were concerned that their children get a good job when they start growing up, because they need to keep the wolf away from the door,
and that we don't experience what they did, right?
We didn't feel that, you know. We just we kind of grew up in that beautiful boredom of the 50s, you know.
You're going to love this joke. You know, we were all these kids back then, but just think of all the anarchists that kids were looking at. I'm not kidding. Dennis the Menace is an anarchist. Okay. Clarabelle with his seltzer bottle is kind of anarchistic. Mm-hmm. The Three Stooges, the people, things we love, were all sending signals about, you know, and the Coke commercials for those who think young, you know. We were incredibly encouraged just to, you know, maybe be a little bratty. I don't know, but it brought about a huge revolution.
Well, then, so the rebellion of the 60s, I kind of see it as coming out, in my view, coming out of a sort of a dead space of the 50s. Now,
yeah.
I think there was a lot going on in the 50s, but, you know, particularly like the wellsprings of music, but the rebellious stage against the homeostasis, you know, that everything, nothing is changing, and it needs to change.
I'm with you. And, you know, first Dr. King, this is real important, they showed everybody it could be done, right?
Right, right.
And then amazingly, then 1970 starts feminism, and then 70 starts Earth Day, and then the gay thing started. They all saw that it could be done, you know?
Well, you know, Black Power, the people that took the risks. And there's always those leaders that will take the risks for the rest of society. They'll take the punishment. They'll expose themselves to police brutality, imprisonment. All these things, these come from these precious leaders of our society. And you go back and you say, okay, the women's movement, and then you become aware, well, gee, the women started way back when, you know, with suffragettes.
Yep. World War One,
turn of the century, and during that era when there was a lot of awakening. And then I think a lot of that was lost, and maybe it was lost due to the poverty of the Great Depression and the war. But the fathers worked and mothers largely stayed at home.
Okay, so I'll tell you, we talk about the 50s being quiet. That could be me.
Listen to some music here.
Okay.
Yeah, there we go.
Now, I'll tell you, you know, what we talk about the 50s, you know, our parents, there was still an enormous psychic wound from World War II. You know, the 50s was a bare 5 years after that. And so we have to remember that. They just wanted to get on with it, you know, and give their children everything that they couldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
We got to remember that. You know, what did they say in, what did John Trudell say? Father didn't always know best.
Yeah, but he ruled with a firm hand.
Right. But then the 60s basically started a questioning of anything that was what you would call unquestioned authority, kind of a patriarch thing. You know, you think about it, that's really what it was chipping away at.
Right, right. But then what happened? You know, if you were there for the 60s and if you liked what you saw the burst of freedom, You saw John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King. You saw all of this happening. You saw the end of the Vietnam War and what people did through clamoring in the streets. And then you had great hope for the future, but something happened then.
Well, hey, Joe, Peter, Paul, and Mary were much more key to things than people know now, but Paul Stuckey did it really well. He says this, okay, we started the 60s and they had magazines called Life. Then after the 60s, there's a magazine called People. And then a little more time goes by and there's a new magazine called Us. And then the next magazine is Self. It became progressively more self-absorbed, and that is so true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's when there was the advent of who's number one, you know, you're number one, I'm number one sort of thing. That emphasis on the self, and in a way, this was part, in my view, of a justification of capitalism itself, because capitalism is largely driven by and based on greed and the justification for greed. And if you put yourself in the first position and you justify that, then you can explain why you took more than somebody else and it was okay. And I think that that was kind of, there was a lot of emphasis put on that to get us through the next era as we moved into what I think is now a stranglehold of capitalism on us, where we've been manipulated into becoming the quiet consumers, the good consumers.
Well, the willingness to be so in debt. And I often thought, Joe, that the key, the real loss of freedom is when you have, if you get a loan and there's interest on it, that means you're penalized for being poor. Because mm-hmm. if you have sure. money, you don't, there's no penalty. You don't need to borrow. So that's how you start getting the inequality. And then if you have a whole mass cultural emphasis on having more and keeping up with your neighbors, the bigger house and all that, and you're willing to go in debt, I think it's the interest and the willingness to go in debt that's really almost fatal.
It is, and I think that's the capture. When you come out of college and you're saddled with this debt, you don't have the space or the opportunity for freedom and creativity. You've got to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the capture.
That's right where we are now, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Realizing that it doesn't work.
And, we could talk an awful lot on this subject, and I want to talk more about it in future shows. But I want to use the little bit of time we have left and talk about what you've been working on with the Civil War story, the family in Jefferson County here in Shepherdstown that was divided in conflict between the North and the South.
And you know what I'd like to do, Joe? We have an unparalleled narrative from our county on the Civil War. We had so many good writers. But what I wanted to do is read two things, and they're 1861 in Jefferson County. But what they really are doing is, we're talking about people losing their judgment, getting carried away with ideas and getting swept along with notions, which is sort of even like today if you look at some of the political candidates. Just listen to this. Think of people giving up their independent judgment. You're in Charlestown, and the Observer is David Hunter Strother, and he's watching young boys deciding whether they should enlist in the Confederacy or not. Day after day, he saw the baskets, this is the young boy, the baskets loaded with choice viands, roasted fowls, pickles, cakes, and potted sweetmeats, but not for him. And wherever he went, there was a braiding of caps and coats, a gathering of flowers and weaving of wreaths, but not for him. No scented and embroidered handkerchiefs waved from carriages and from windows as he rode by. The genial flood of social sympathy upon which he had hitherto floated so blandly had left him stranded on the icy shore. So he's not joining the Confederacy, and all the girls don't want to be with him anymore. But the social pressure to conform is almost comically described. The motivations of young men aren't ideological. It's whether the girls like you or not, and whether you want adventure, yeah, and you want to ride a horse.
That's a good one. That's a good point. You know, I guess we sure do a lot for to find and capture a mate. And so you're saying
people
there
are still the same in certain ways.
Yeah, and nature hasn't changed that much. Although it seems like sometimes we're doing our best to get in the way of it, or mess it up, or kill it off, or do something like that.
Can I try another one? We're talking about social order, respect, dialogue, communication, well-established, just suddenly getting on an emotional roller coaster, and how friendships are destroyed, and it all just sort of falls apart. This also is in Jefferson County. This is our story. And here's what David Hunter Strother said, who, by the way, was born in Martinsburg. His wife lived in Charlestown. He became a general in the Federal Army. But this is so pertinent today. Here's what he says. Talk about your relationships falling apart. By the month of June 1861, the circle of more robust characters that still retained their political sanity was small and diminishing daily. They did not drop off now after long and lingering arguments, painful doubts, and rallyings and relapses as formerly, but a normal mind would fall suddenly into incoherence and frenzy, principles based upon the education and habits of a lifetime, sustained by the clearest views of interest. The pride of consistency and every sentiment of honor would perish in a night like the gourd of Jonah. This change was easily discernible in the countenance and demeanor of its victims. Yesterday, your friend looked in your face with a clear and earnest eye and discussed questions calmly and logically. Today, he shunned you. His eye was restless and unsteady, his manner painfully excited, his talk full of incoherencies. In a short time, you would perceive there was a total absorption of all his previous opinions, idiosyncrasies, social sympathies, and antipathies, moral and intellectual characteristics, in the prevailing frenzy. See how easily people can get swept along, and that's still a lesson for today. That was probably the same environment you saw in Germany in the 1930s with Hitler.
Well, we sure see it today. I know I have difficulty when I have close people that I've known for a long time, and then suddenly realize that there's a huge sector of conversation we don't dare go into because we're just going to flare up at each other and completely not understand, appreciate what the other person is driving at.
You can slide into anarchy much more easily than people think, especially if there's fear, you know, in the society.
Well, yeah, and we do know that there are there's a large segment of the media that focuses on fear, and individuals in the political realm that utilize fear to drive their agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately,
that's why I wanted to share that, because I learn over and over again that the Civil War era, the one thing that's constant with today is human nature, the best and the worst of it. Now, can I say something, Joe? This is for a positive note.
I don't know if we can handle that.
I know. Let's pull ourselves together here.
Give it a shot.
This is especially for people who have a love of horses. And there's one or two of you out there.
That would be me, too. I love them. They don't love me necessarily, but I do love them.
My father was a horse person. You know, he had that magic with him. But what I'm getting at is what we're talking about is this is William Blackford. He was kind of a right-hand number two guy behind Jeb Stuart in the 1st Virginia Cavalry. That is the one that the local boys all joined in Company F same day. But what they're doing is they're all in a hurried 36-hour cavalry march or movement. They've got to get from Bunker Hill to Manassas in 36 hours of hill and dale, and one guy stops and actually buys a big bullfrog from somebody. He dresses it and eats the whole thing whole and lived. Oh, anyway, here's what he says about his horse. This is wonderful stuff. The bond between a horse and its rider is a mystical thing. Another new recruit on that march rode after the war, this is the one I described, speaking for all, to a cavalry officer in active service, his horse is his second self, his companion and friend, upon whom his very life may depend. And then he goes on and says, on this trek, they shared every dust-choked step of his famished progress with his horse. He describes his horse. A dark mahogany bay, almost brown, with black mane, tail, and legs, and a small white star on his forehead. Great eyes standing out like those of a deer. Small, delicate muzzle. Delicate ears in which you could see the veins, in which were in constant motion with every thought which passes through his mind. Small and beautiful feet and legs, as hard as bone itself. When I would be eating on the march, his eyes would watch me, and if I did not soon lean forward and hand him a taste, he would stop deliberately and reach his mouth up for his share. Nothing seemed to come amiss. Bread, crackers, meat, sugar, and fruit all seemed to be relished. I could tie the halter strap to my leg and lie down to sleep, while he would graze around, step over me, or lie down by me without ever treading on me. Sometimes, when he would lie down, he would lay his head in an affectionate, if uncomfortable, manner upon me. And though it was disagreeable, I could never have the heart to push it off. That's for all us horse people.
That's a great little reminiscence. And I do know...
The horse's name is Comet.
Comet, that's a good name. And, you know, there are so many horse people, and they do love their horses immensely. I recently, a neighbor of mine moved away, and she had this gorgeous, gorgeous horse named Winnie. Used to come down the trail there, and they were both great together. They could run through the woods and jump over ditches and all kinds of things. And the horse was extremely gentle and was one of those horses that seemed friendly, that you could walk up to it and... Even if it didn't know you, it didn't seem to have that fear.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I understand, horses have great differences of personality from mm-hmm. one to another. And I have a good friend that had a horse recently. Well, she took care of horses, and she got hurt because the horse is so fantastically muscular.
They're power machines.
It jumped and hit her with its head by accident and busted some teeth out. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're pretty incredible animals. And that's another thing that over the generations we've lost. We've lost that touch with that animal.
That's a lot of what we're saying, is that kind of a world, you know, that we want to preserve, that living nature world.
Right, the loss of touch with that animal, the loss of touch with nature in general. And but Jim, how about a couple of words about this family now?
Okay. Okay, here's what it is.
Back to that.
By Wednesday, I'm going to have four parts on CivilWarScholars.com. The part one is called Newton D. Baker's, quote, most divided clan. Part two is called Newton Baker, quote, sees the elephant. Manassas, Virginia, 1861. The phrase "seize the elephant" is a phrase which means a person sees something beyond comprehension that's very difficult. Part three is called Newton Baker's Life in the Famed 1st Virginia Cavalry. And what I did was really give you a sense of the rhythm and the campsites and the battles, the rhythm of being in cavalry. And God, they were in 200 engagements. Number four is called Newton D. Baker's Remarkable Son. And what I trace is that from four generations, there's rebellion back to the 60s. Mm-hmm. Newton Baker Sr. 1860s. First, there was Elias Baker Sr. He was called I call him the Unforgiven. He deserted the family in the 1830s in Bakersville, Washington County. Get the point there. Mm-hmm. So what does his son do? Elias Jr. moves to Shepherdstown, marries a good girl from the big Bill Meyer family, and he rebels by being a good family man. He's a saddle maker, lives in Van Cleesville, then he runs a store where the Scheherazade is. And his uncle is David Bill Meyer, who is very wealthy and very union man. But it's a family. And they lived at the brick house that's just up German Street, just a little, a red brick house on the north side of the street. So that's his rebellion. And he becomes the U.S. government's postmaster in Shepherdstown, where his store was. Wouldn't you know, your kid, just the way kids are, he's going to do exactly opposite what you want him to do. Mm-hmm. And my point is, August 18th, a whole avalanche of Bill Myers and Lemons, those are their big names around here, an avalanche of them. I have all their names and service records. All join Company F of 1st Virginia Cavalry, and William Morgan, who's a wonderful character who lived at Falling Spring, another Shepherdstown, was the commander. All in one day, boom, April 18th. And you can just picture Newton. He's only 19. He's in his dad's store. He's feeling the pressure. He's not joined yet. And, you know, all the other cousins have. Then it gets to be June 15th. All the Confederate Army is up and leaving. They've been training at Harper's Ferry, and suddenly they're in motion and they're leaving town. He's got one more chance to join them. And, you know, he at the very last minute, he breaks. And he rides his horse over to the encampment, which is the whole army has marched through Charlestown, and they're going to eventually get to Manassas. He finds the 1st Cavalry at Bullskin Run and says, "Here I am." But it's the very last chance he had, you know, and his father did not talk to him for the whole war, except once when he was a prisoner of war. His horse was shot out from under him. He was wounded. And I believe the time his father came to see him at Fort McHenry. And you can just easily imagine the father he was exchanged. You can easily see his father taking him back to Shepherdstown. But, of course, he promptly rejoined. So you have all this old dynamic. The war ends, and the father dies shortly thereafter. And what's fascinating, you find more and more men who become doctors. They saw so much blood. Mm. He became a very respected doctor in Martinsburg. And wouldn't you know, he has a son born in Martinsburg in 1872. Remember, we had this little theme going of rebelling? Mm-hmm. Well, his father was always this old Confederate guy. You know, that's his calling card. And his son Newton was very studious and kind of short and small, and they called him Angel Boy, and, you know, kind of not exactly a stripling guy, but a very profound reader. I think he read the whole encyclopedia and all this. He grows up, he rebels. And he jokingly called himself a carpetbagger going into the North. He went to Johns Hopkins, becomes the mayor of Cleveland. He becomes a famous progressive, very thoughtful. And wouldn't you know it, a fellow Virginian, Woodrow Wilson, who there's some things that aren't attractive about President Wilson now. He said, "Would you be my Secretary of War? Looks like we're headed for war." So Newton D. Baker, another Baker, rebels against the dad, becomes a progressive, and becomes an extremely esteemed Secretary of War. And we remember him because on Route 9, we have the Newton D. Baker Veterans Hospital. Mm-hmm. That's the tale of the Baker family.
Wow. Well, this divide that existed in the family, number one, was it along ideological lines, or was there something else?
No. You know, the kids, what you find out is this is so true today. They didn't, it's not the ideology. You went for adventure. I have guys saying, when you were a kid, you as soon as your feet could reach the stirrup, you were on the back of a horse. You grew up on the back of a horse with a gun, and you chased and shot squirrels that were running from tree to tree. What we talked about, roaming, you grew up that way. You could shoot a gun and ride a horse as soon as you were 2 feet tall. So it was the adventure.
But why did they choose one side as opposed to the other?
This was Virginia. And what the great tragedy is, Robert E. Lee, slavery is awful. We know that. We know that it needs to be dealt with and understood. But when Lincoln wanted 75,000 volunteers, it played out a certain way that you were forced to say, like Lee, you got to fight for the United States Army against those you grew up with. And it's almost impossible to do. Mm-hmm. And that's the dilemma they had. You would still go with your tribe. And, you know, you were still a Virginian more than you were an American. But you must understand what's fascinating is Shepherdstown had about 40 households that were Union all during the war. That's why Shepherdstown's so fascinating. It juggled every point of view, and that's how they learned to be patient with one another. We have that today.
So, did any of these people ever face one another in the course of
exactly
of
what
the
I was
war.
Looking for? And I carefully looked at the different units. You know, the ones in the north were the 1st Maryland U.S. Cavalry. I noticed a very interesting thing, how when there was a divided family, particularly one of the North, would be assigned as a steward or be assigned as a non-combatant role. They weren't stupid. You know, they just weren't going to go right after their brother. Mm. And, you know, that's the pattern. Craigiel was a divided family in Charlestown. Two of them were on the southern side. The one in the North asked to be kept at West Point to teach. Mm-hmm. That's the new discovery, is they would find ways to have non-combatant roles so they weren't going to shoot a gun at a relative.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's...
And it makes sense.
That's admirable in a sense. Yeah, I can dig that. So, Jim, now you're going to come back and join me next week, right?
Yes, we're going to have a really great fundraiser, and I'll talk about it next week. On February 6th, it's called Keep the Lights On at the Black Box Art Center, which is there on Princess Street. And we have a incredible list of musicians that are going to be with us at 8 p.m. on next Saturday, February 6th. Eldred Hill, patent pending, Keith Dill, Ralph Gordon, Ardith Gilbertson doing jazz, and Jenny Avila, Terry Tucker. If you notice, these are all people who do their own music. And we're going to have the young girl who they did Annie, Isabella Warburton. Got a couple of actors doing a wonderful comedy routine called Beyond Therapy, Pat Markland and Rhonda Kisner. It'll be a great night. Cassie Ray. Cassie Ray's going to do her stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be a really good night. All the money goes to keeping the Black Box doors open, because it's run entirely by volunteers with big hearts.
Okay, super. And are you going to have some of these folks dropping in, or what?
I'll bring them over.
You bring them over. Okay, great. Sounds like a fun show. Well, that kind of wraps up our show today, unless you have any closing
remarks.
No, it's
been great.
Yeah, I've enjoyed hanging out with you, Jim, as always. And you're listening to Seven Generations Radio. This is WSHC Shepherdstown. Thank you for tuning in. We'll be back next week with some more great tales for you, and we may even talk about some more of this generational stuff. Who knows? Yeah. Take care now, and we'll see you next week.